It's time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Once again, good morning. What a great Thursday morning. We're just back in town. We were just south of Yorkton with the East Central Research Foundation folks who are on tour there. I would guess there's probably maybe 75 to 80 people. They had three wagons going with people on board. We have more about that. On the program today as well, Harry Siemens is going to join us, as he often does, take a look at the crop development in Manitoba, as well as we look at the crop report here in Saskatchewan. Also on the program today, barley coming into its own. Just watch us, says Barley Development Director Zenith Fay of West Bend. And we continue an ongoing salute to Canada 150. Fur trade forts in the area played a major role in early agriculture. Like I'm talking fur trade days here. We update that with Cease McNee. I won't call him an amateur historian because he's much more than that. And what can we learn from cemeteries? Lots, says Brian Watson, one of the organizers of a tour of historic heritage cemeteries in the arms of Churchbridge and Langenberg. I'll be joining that tour tomorrow. We'll give you some insights with Brian Watson a little later on the program. So, as always, we've got about 3 hours of material here for you folks to get us through the next hour. Well, the crop report today, as you would expect, suggesting that lack of rain and crop damage is the major cause of crop damage. Also, high temperatures, as we've been going into. Hard to believe that this time last year there was an excess of soil moisture, I think, in just about 90% of the province. But as we know, things do and can change. Now, the crop is developing as it should. Normally, according to the weekly crop report, 56% of the fall cereals, 64% of spring cereals, 62% of oilseeds, 75% of the pulse crops are at their normal stages of development for this time of year. And of course, that being said, there's always the other end of the scale. There's some very dry areas. There's still about 2% with surplus moisture, but as always, that a mixed bag that we see. Some areas received rain in the past week. Of course, it rains from just a few tenths. In fact, at Saltcoats, the little shower the other night was at Sunday. I don't think we even got a tenth, but they had 80 millimeters, as much as 2 inches and more, 3 inches and more at Kelvington. And of course, that big thunderstorm Monday night in areas north, some of them got 3 and 4 inches out of that. So now that event is, of course, probably isn't factored into this week's report. Now, the Crop District 5, of which we're part, covers Melville, Yorkton, Cupar, Camsack, Foam Lake, Priestville, Kelvington areas. Again, 23% of the hay crop has now been cut, and 31% of it is baled or put into silage. Hay quality, though, is suffering right across the province. 14% excellent in this District 5, and 18% fair, 7% poor, which I guess, again, is almost a normal kind of a year in some ways. Producers reporting hay yields, though, are significantly lower than what they consider normal, sometimes as much as 50% lower. So that's the way it's developing right now here in Saskatchewan. Harry Siemens is on the line with us. He's actually across the line in the USA. We hope they let him back home to Winkler eventually. But, Harry, as always, when you're traveling, you're on the Twitter feed. What are your Twitterizers telling you about the crops in Manitoba right now?
I think for the most part, on Tuesday night, and that's when we sat in the Walmart store in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, because there were heavy tornado warnings and a heavy storm. Luckily, not a tornado, but still strong winds. But that same day, there were rains in Manitoba that went anywhere from south of Winkler for, you know, an inch and a half and 7/10 to north and east, and then not so much going west. So for the most part, when I talk to my followers from Wawanisa to Steinbach to the Interlake, the crop is looking really good. Soybeans are still a little bit yellow at places because it was so cool, and yet people are thinking they're going to recover. So It looks like we've got a good crop coming. Eldon Klippenstein at Altona, Manitoba, he tells me it's looking really promising. So we're going to have to wait and see. But I think for the most part, Corey Peters at Steinbeck says looking good. He says the canola is starting to slow down and blooming. So you know what? We've got lots of canola all around. We've got lots of soybeans, 2.3 million acres of soybeans in Manitoba this year, the official acre tally. And so I think we're in, you know, and when I come up here to Detroit Lakes, and right now I'm sitting here in Fargo, you know, the crop here isn't as good. They've had some drought. They've had some places too much moisture. But all in all, it's not looking as good on this side of the border, meaning the United States, as it is on the Manitoba side. So we'll have to wait and see.
So, Harry, I'm wondering, do you have any Twitter companions up in the northwest Manitoba crop zone, Roblin, Swanavery, which, of course, are more or less adjacent to us here on this side of the Mansask border? Any insights from up that way?
Not any more further than Rivers, which is more north than it is south-northwest. I can't say at this point that I got anybody reporting back to me. I did it kind of in a hurry this morning, so they may well have reported, but at this point I can't say anything.
Yeah, and I think from what I've read of the official Manitoba government crop report, conditions there pretty much that in that Roblin, Swan River area are, again, I think it's, as always, there's a variation, but things appear to be fairly good and fairly normal crop development. Harry, you're going to get...
My brother-in-law drove up from Clear Lake up to Detroit Lakes on Monday of last week, and that's when he said that that the crops there, especially the soybeans, were just not quite as good. But we've had some heat, maybe some moisture. They'll come around.
Right on. We're going to get back with Harry and chat. He's had with a farmer in Minnesota. But back here in just south of Yorkton, as we mentioned, the East Central Research Foundation tour was underway. The guy who coordinates it all is Mike Hall. I had a chat with him just before the tour started up this morning, and Scott's going to cue that up for me. They had, Mike is going to describe quite a wide range of topics that they're covering, including Mr. Fertilizer Regis Karamanos, who's now with Cook Fertilizers. But first of all, so here's that chat with Mike Hall.
All right. This is with Mike Hall at the East Central Research Foundation field tour. So, so Mike, you've got quite a lineup today. Sort of give us a quick overview of what the people are going to tour.
I've pushed a lot of things together today, so I'm going to have to push my speakers to get through it all. But, yeah, we're looking at everything from faba beans to lentils and a bunch of sclerotinia-resistant canola. And we're also looking at the 4Rs for either nitrogen management or phosphorus management. We also have forage corn studies and quinoa studies, which is not a very common crop, so people are always curious about that, and looking at flax, and then we're going over to our cereal site, and we'll look at different ways of managing, you know, oats and barley, you know, with losing pre-harvest Roundup as an option for oats. That's sort of something we're experimenting with. You know, how else can we hasten maturity now that grain millers won't accept varieties treated with pre-harvest Roundup? And I'm sure I've missed some stuff in there. Yeah.
So how do you decide on these research projects?
Well, a lot of it, you know, we have trials that we can apply for that are specific interest to local farmers and our board members. And we also get involved in projects with our sister sites. You know, ECRF is part of something called AgriArm, and there's about six sites scattered across Saskatchewan. And oftentimes we will overlap and do the same trial at many sites to get more site years within a given period of time. So someone may take the lead for that, for example, from another site.
Right. So you have a board of directors and you have a couple of staff who are here?
Yeah, they're busy right now putting the picnic tables on a trailer, and we're getting ready for people to come in and tour the plots.
So who are your staff?
We have Heather Sorstad and Brendan Zuba.
And what's their role?
They're summer people. So they're
are they university students? Or?
Yep.
That again, Mike Hall with the East Central Research Foundation, chat we had just before the tour began this morning. Now, we took a look at faba beans, fascinating story there. Brief look at some canola plots. They're also looking at oats, barley, as you heard from Mike Hall. FMC herbicides, Damon Paley, one of the speakers this morning, some winter wheat, forage corn, it's all there. But I think a lot of people really perk up their ears when this man, Regis Karamanis, speaks. He's now with Cook Fertilizer, and he was there to talk about the R's, the right place, the right time, and all that good stuff with fertilizer application.
We are talking about the right source, the right time, the right place, and the right rate. And one thing that we have to keep in mind is we cannot really separate it, you know, the four. They have to be all four practice at the right, you know, all the 4 hours practice at the same time. So when we are talking about the right product at the right time, I was very fortunate to succeed the father of deep bonding, John Harapiak at Wesco, and still deep bonding of nitrogen fertilizer remains the golden standard. And when I say deep bonding, I mean bonding at 2.5-3 inches deep. Still remains the golden standard, still research, even the research that I've been doing in my position over the last 3 years just verifies that, you know, you can take all these products here, they are stabilized. Once you deep bond them, they're not any better than urea is deep bonded. So we have to keep that in mind. However, what happens these days, and pardon for my expression, people cheat. They don't deep bond. They either shallow bond or broadcast. And there are some really good reasons why people broadcast or shallow bond fertilizer these days. Deep bonding means 4.5-5 miles an hour. Shallow bonding, well, when you bring the implement up to 1/2 inch or 1 inch, you can go a little bit faster, especially in one pass systems. And broadcasting, you can go even faster, as fast as 12, 15 miles an hour now with the new spreaders. And people that have...
That again, Regis Karamanis, Mr. Fertilizer, just really scratching the surface there with that piece. We'll have to pick it up in future programs. Just great insights from Regis. Now, we're going to check back with our buddy Harry Siemens, an interview he's done for us with a farmer from Minnesota. But just on the topic of crop tours, a reminder that the Rock Parish and Heimbecker, as well as Value Tire in Yorkton, invite you to take the bus next Wednesday. We're on our second annual excursion to Ag in Motion. That bus will leave the Gallagher Center Wednesday, July 19th at 6 in the morning, return from Saskatoon by about 8:30 or 8:40 p.m. The trip will include a quick supper stop at Wynyard, the tab picked up by our sponsors. So during the day, you're on your own on the grounds, but everything else is looked after. So you can leave me a message here at The Rock, shoot me an email, text or email, whichever, or you can contact Cody or John at Value Tire or Captain Dave Thomas and his crew at Parrish and Heimbecker. More about Ag in Motion a little later in the program. So, Harry, you are you're a typical workaholic and holidaying in Minnesota, but you got talking to some farmers, of course. Were these guys sitting back with a cool one, or what was happening there?
You know, I actually went to the church service at the campground, and there was a fella by the name of Gus Ziegler who's in charge of the service. And so we got talking, and then we got talking. He also farms about 15 minutes east of Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, just around Frazee, Minnesota, and I used to golf there a fair bit. And so he talked about a day coming up, August the 5th, and August and Betty Ziegler want to show the public that being a farmer is about being a good steward of the land. That's why they chose to host East Otter Tail County's first ever breakfast on the farm coming up August the 5th. And he invited me down to the farm, so my wife Judith and I drove down there on Tuesday morning, and we thought we would go for coffee and talk a little bit, but 2.5 hours later, we left, and he invited me back on August the 5th to maybe even participate and give a little message from Canada. But he talked about how initially he thought he might have 50 neighbors come. Then he gave it over to a bigger organization, and then they talked 500, and now he says we're getting ready for 1,000. So that's interesting, and here's the chat that I had with August Ziegler just a few miles east of Frazee, Minnesota.
Well, as of now, we have a little over 1,000 acres yet. We sold off one big field. It was a 250-acre irrigated field. That's kind of our retirement, and the rest here will be left for our children. The reason I sold that particular piece off is it's my theory that the man who, my theology, I should say, is a man who works the land ought to have a right to own it rather than some rich man gaining the profits. And, you know, so that's kind of why I sold that a little bit to question whether I should have or not, because maybe somewhere our grandchildren will want to farm. I don't know, but I kind of doubt that. We raise now potatoes, soybeans, edible beans, corn, and alfalfa. Potatoes and edible beans were the two big crops where we made our big money on. Soybeans and corn is always marginal, unless like we had 5 years ago with the boom. When I was a child here with no irrigation, farming was very marginal. It was oats, corn, and alfalfa. And corn was checked so you could cultivate it either way. Soybeans weren't heard of. Oats was a crop that did best because of the earlier rains. And out of those three crops, you could figure if you got two, you had a good year. You know, that's how farming was. My father and brothers made a living doing it that way. But when we came back from Africa in 93, I had no idea that I was going to be able to buy that farm and 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 put them all together with 10, 12 irrigation pivots on.
The 1,000 acres left is all irrigated?
No, only 400 left is irrigated. The rest is woodlands. There's about 100 acres of dry corners, of which I still farm myself, but this being my last year, goofing up once in a while with machinery and causing me some problems because I don't think like I should anymore, I guess. I don't know. This is going to be my last year of 100 acres of hay.
Okay. So animals?
Animals. There are 7 steers around the corner down here, 9 steers. I get them just for old time's sake and feed them out. And last year, even though the prices weren't too bad, I got a good buddy buyer who buys them on a good price and sells them on a good price for me. So I come out ahead. This year I bought some goats for the big fete that's coming up. We're going to have a sow with little ones here and rabbits and chickens of different age so the children can see how fast the chicken grows. And hope that this event will be an educational for children as well.
Tell me, how did this event start, and then tell me about the event?
Well, the event started in the fact that I wanted to do this for the last number of years when I retired, just to help people understand that farmers are trying to be the best stewards of the land as they can be, but oftentimes they're judged because they maybe put on too much water, so the public thinks, or they put on too much chemical or too much fertilizer or whatever. But in all reality, the water is all monitored. We'll explain that at the event today, next month. Chemicals are monitored, fertilizer is monitored, nitrogen especially these days. That will be some of the educational stuff, as well as a big trailer of safety for children, for animals, an introduction to where does the milk come from, and where, what do goats have in common, males and females? Do you know what that is? They have a beard.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, we apologize, of course, for the wind noise there, just as you heard in some of the Regis Caramanus cut we had earlier. Our buddy Harry Siemens talking to a farmer in Minnesota. Maybe an inspiration there for more folks to kind of follow that pattern. I just want to mention again about the Ag in Motion next week. There are actually two buses going out of Yorkton, the one between the Rock Pershen, Heimbecker, and Value Tire. And, of course, that's going to be the best one, leaving from Yorkton at 6 o'clock in the morning next Wednesday. Now, the Ag Ministry, in conjunction, I believe, with RBC, also have a bus going that day. They're leaving a little later, I think. I'm not exactly sure what the return plan is, but you can check with Rachel Kranick at the Ag office if you want to check in on that one. So those are upcoming. Also mentioned next Tuesday, July 18th, is the IHARF tour at Indian Head, the research foundation there. Melfort is on July 26th. Now, also on July 26th, Seedmaster at Langbank are going to roll out some new technology, but it's also going to happen at Ag in Motion, and we may get a chance to tell you more about that a little bit later on the program. Well, Harry Siemens is with us, and Harry, we're going to get you to give us some insight on this next story as we take another look at what's happening with PED in Saskatchewan. The Saskatchewan hog industry on notice of continued threat from the PED virus, a virulent strain which kills young pigs by the score. Now, with 51 Manitoba farms now confirmed with PED, Saskatchewan veterinarian specialist Dr. Wendy Wilkins says every Manitoba case increases the risk for Saskatchewan.
Yes, exactly. I think so. With every new case, there's more opportunities for the virus to get out into the environment and to be in places where it can be picked up by either farm suppliers or transport trucks and brought back to Saskatchewan.
This next clip might be a bit confusing, so heads up. The PED metaphor she uses here comes in red paint.
Biosecurity, 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 and if everybody in the industry doesn't know by now what that means, they've been under a rock, I think. Definitely make sure that you're taking every step you can not to bring that virus back. Make sure the trucks are cleaned and washed. You know, use the better truck washes where you can do a heat dry, which kills the virus. Don't get out of your truck if you don't have to. I guess just essentially, just think of if there's red paint on a pig barn or in the yard, do everything you can to keep that red paint off you, your equipment, your truck, and keep that red paint from coming back to Saskatchewan. It's just a way of visualizing. We can't see the virus, but if we can imagine that a PED-positive environment covered in red paint, then perhaps that helps us visualize that virus better.
That again, Wendy Wilkins. She's asked if or where things might have gone wrong in Manitoba.
There's been no one single problem. The investigation is ongoing, and with each new premise, there can be something different. To date, things that have been implicated are direct movement of pigs between barns. So if you can imagine, if you have a barn that has PED in it and nobody knows, and then they move pigs to another farm, it's going to spread the virus between farms. And the same thing.
Give us a quick overview of what the people are going to tour.
I've pushed a lot of things together today, so I'm going to have to push my speakers to get through it all. But, yeah, we're looking at everything from faba beans to lentils and a bunch of sclerotinia-resistant canola. And we're also looking at the 4Rs for either nitrogen management or phosphorus management. We also have forage corn studies and quinoa studies, which is not a very common crop, so people are always curious about that, and looking at flax, and then we're going over to our cereal site, and we'll look at different ways of managing, you know, oats and barley, you know, with losing pre-harvest Roundup as an option for oats. That's sort of something we're experimenting with. You know, how else can we hasten maturity now that grain millers won't accept varieties treated with pre-harvest Roundup? And I'm sure I've missed some stuff in there. Yeah.
So how do you decide on these research projects?
Well, a lot of it, you know, we have trials that we can apply for that are specific interest to local farmers and our board members. And we also get involved in projects with our sister sites. You know, ECRF is part of something called AgriArm, and there's about 6 sites scattered across Saskatchewan. And oftentimes we will overlap and do the same trial at many sites to get more site years within a given period of time. So someone may take the lead for that, for example, from another site.
Right. So you have a board of directors and you have a couple of staff who are here?
Yeah, they're busy right now putting the picnic tables on a trailer, and we're getting ready for people to come in and tour the plots.
So who are your staff?
We have Heather Sorstad and Brendan Zuba.
And what's their role?
They're summer people. So they're
are they university students? Or?
Yep.
That again, Mike Hall with the East Central Research Foundation, chat we had just before the tour began this morning. Now we took a look at faba beans, fascinating story there. Brief look at some canola plots. They're also looking at oats, barley, as you heard from Mike Hall. FMC herbicides, Damon Paley, one of the speakers this morning, some winter wheat, forage corn, it's all there. But I think a lot of people really perk up their ears when this man, Regis Karamanis, speaks. He's now with Cook Fertilizer, and he was there to talk about the R's, the right place, the right time, and all that good stuff with fertilizer application.
We are talking about the right source, the right time, the right place, and the right rate. And one thing that we have to keep in mind is we cannot really separate it, you know, the four. They have to be all four practice at the right, you know, all the four R's practice at the same time. So when we are talking about the right product at the right time, I was very fortunate to succeed the father of deep banding, John Harapiak at Wesco, and still deep banding of nitrogen fertilizer remains the golden standard. And when I say deep banding, I mean banding at 2.5-3 inches deep. Still remains the golden standard, still research, even the research that I've been doing in my new position over the last 3 years just verifies that, you know, you can take all these products here, they are stabilized. Once you deep bund them, they're not any better than urea is deep bunded. So we have to keep that in mind. However, what happens these days, and pardon for my expression, people cheat. They don't deep bund. They either shallow bund or broadcast. And there are some really good reasons why people broadcast or shallow bund fertilizer these days. Deep bunding means 4.5-5 miles an hour. Shallow bunding, well, when you bring the implement up to 1/2 inch or 1 inch, you can go a little bit faster, especially in one pass systems. And broadcasting, you can go even faster, as fast as 12, 15 miles an hour now with the new spreaders. And people that have...
That again, Regis Karamanis, Mr. Fertilizer, just really scratching the surface there with that piece. We'll have to pick it up in future programs. Just great insights from Regis. Now, we're going to check back with our buddy Harry Siemens, an interview he's done for us with a farmer from Minnesota. But just on the topic of crop tours, a reminder that the Rock Parish and Heimbecker, as well as Value Tire in Yorkton, invite you to take the bus next Wednesday. We're on our second annual excursion to Ag in Motion. That bus will leave the Gallagher Center Wednesday, July 19th at 6 in the morning, return from Saskatoon by about 8:30 or 8:40 p.m. The trip will include a quick supper stop at Wynyard, the tab picked up by our sponsors. So during the day, you're on your own on the grounds, but everything else is looked after. So you can leave me a message here at The Rock, shoot me an email, text or email, whichever, or you can contact Cody or John at Value Tire or Captain Dave Thomas and his crew at Parrish and Heimbecker. More about Ag in Motion a little later in the program. So, Harry, you are you're a typical workaholic and holidaying in Minnesota, but you got talking to some farmers, of course. Were these guys sitting back with a cool one, or what was happening there?
You know, I actually went to the church service at the campground, and there was a fellow by the name of Gus Ziegler who's in charge of the service. And so we got talking, and then we got talking. He also farms about 15 minutes east of Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, just around Frazee, Minnesota. And I used to golf there a fair bit. And so he talked about a day is coming up, August the 5th, and August and Betty Ziegler want to show the public that being a farmer is about being a good steward of the land. That's why they chose to host East Otter Tail County's first ever breakfast on the farm coming up August the 5th. And he invited me down to the farm, so my wife Judith and I drove down there on Tuesday morning, and we thought we would go for coffee and talk a little bit, but 2.5 hours later, we left, and he invited me back on August the 5th to maybe even participate and give a little message from Canada. But he talked about how initially he thought he might have 50 neighbors come. Then he gave it over to a bigger organization, and then they talked 500, and now he says we're getting ready for 1,000. So that's interesting, and here's the chat that I had with August Ziegler just a few miles east of Frazee, Minnesota.
Well, as of now, we have a little over 1,000 acres yet. We sold off one big field. It was a 250-acre irrigated field. That's kind of our retirement, and the rest here will be left for our children. The reason I sold that particular piece off is it's my theory that the man who, my theology, I should say, is a man who works the land ought to have a right to own it rather than some rich man gaining the profits. And, you know, so that's kind of why I sold that a little bit to question whether I should have or not, because maybe somewhere our grandchildren will want a farm. I don't know, but I kind of doubt that. We raise now potatoes, soybeans, edible beans, corn, and alfalfa. Potatoes and edible beans were the two big crops where we made our big money on. Soybeans and corn is always marginal, unless like we had 5 years ago with the boom. When I was a child here with no irrigation, farming was very marginal. It was oats, corn, and alfalfa. And corn was checked so you could cultivate it either way. Soybeans weren't heard of. Oats was a crop that did best because of the earlier rains. And out of those three crops, you could figure if you got two, you had a good year. You know, that's how farming was. My father and brothers made a living doing it that way. But when we came back from Africa in 93, I had no idea that I was going to be able to buy that farm and 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 put them all together with 10, 12 irrigation pivots on.
The 1,000 acres left is all irrigated?
No, only 400 left is irrigated. The rest is woodlands. There's about 100 acres of dry corners, of which I still farm myself, but this being my last year, goofing up once in a while with machinery and causing me some problems because I don't think like I should anymore, I guess. I don't know. This is going to be my last year of 100 acres of hay.
Okay. So animals?
Animals. There are 7 steers around the corner down here, 9 steers. I get them just for old time's sake and feed them out. And last year, even though the prices weren't too bad, I got a good buddy buyer who buys them on a good price and sells them on a good price for me, so I come out ahead. This year I bought some goats for the big fete that's coming up. We're going to have a sow with little ones here, and rabbits and chickens of different age so the children can see how fast the chicken grows, and hope that this event will be an educational for children as well.
Tell me, how did this event start, and then tell me about the event?
Well, the event started in the fact that I wanted to do this for the last number of years when I retired, just to help people understand that farmers are trying to be the best stewards of the land as they can be, but oftentimes they're judged because they maybe put on too much water, so the public thinks, or they put on too much chemical or too much fertilizer or whatever. But in all reality, the water is all monitored. We'll explain that at the event today, next month. Chemicals are monitored, fertilizer is monitored, nitrogen especially these days. That will be some of the educational stuff, as well as a big trailer of safety for children, for animals, an introduction to where does the milk come from, and what do goats have in common, males and females? Do you know what that is? They have a beard.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, we apologize, of course, for the wind noise there, just as you heard in some of the Regis Karamanis cut we had earlier. Our buddy Harry Siemens talking to a farmer in Minnesota. Maybe an inspiration there for more folks to kind of follow that pattern. I just want to mention again about the Ag in Motion next week. There are actually two buses going out of Yorkton, the one between The Rock, Parrish and Heimbecker, and Value Tire. And, of course, that's going to be the best one, leaving from Yorkton at 6 o'clock in the morning next Wednesday. Now, the Ag Ministry, in conjunction, I believe, with RBC, also have a bus going that day. They're leaving a little later, I think. I'm not exactly sure what the return plan is, but you can check with Rachel Kranick at the Ag office if you want to check in on that one. So those are upcoming. Also mentioned next Tuesday, July 18th, is the IHARF tour at Indian Head, the research foundation there. Melfort is on July 26th. Now, also on July 26th, Seedmaster at Langbank are going to roll out some new technology, but it's also going to happen at Ag in Motion, and we may get a chance to tell you more about that a little bit later on the program. Well, Harry Siemens is with us, and Harry, we're going to get you to give us some insight on this next story as we take another look at what's happening with PED in Saskatchewan. The Saskatchewan hog industry on notice of continued threat from the PED virus, a virulent strain which kills young pigs by the score. Now, with 51 Manitoba farms now confirmed with PED, Saskatchewan veterinarian specialist Dr. Wendy Wilkins says every Manitoba case increases the risk for Saskatchewan.
Yes, exactly. I think so. With every new case, there's more opportunities for the virus to get out into the environment and to be in places where it can be picked up by either farm suppliers or transport trucks and brought back to Saskatchewan.
This next clip might be a bit confusing, so heads up. The PED metaphor she uses here comes in red paint.
Biosecurity, biosecurity, biosecurity. And if everybody in the industry doesn't know by now what that means, they've been under a rock, I think. Definitely make sure that you're taking every step you can not to bring that virus back. Make sure the trucks are cleaned and washed. You know, use the better truck washes where you can do a heat dry, which kills the virus. Don't get out of your truck if you don't have to. I guess just essentially, just think of if there's red paint on a pig barn or in the yard, do everything you can to keep that red paint off you, your equipment, your truck, and keep that red paint from coming back to Saskatchewan. It's just a way of visualizing. We can't see the virus, but if we can imagine that a PED-positive environment covered in red paint, then perhaps that helps us visualize that virus better.
That again, Wendy Wilkins. She's asked if or where things might have gone wrong in Manitoba.
There's been no one single problem. The investigation is ongoing, and with each new premise, there can be something different. To date, things that have been implicated are direct movement of pigs between barns. So if you can imagine, if you have a barn that has PED in it and nobody knows, and then they move pigs to another farm, it's going to spread the virus between farms. And the same thing
about our early free trade history by a local newspaper man. By digging into the diaries of early European explorer Daniel Harmon and one Archibald MacLeod, a senior manager with the Northwest Fur Trade Company, McNee learned a lot. MacLeod was stationed in the lower Fort de Prairie department in 1794-95, and in 1800 he was in charge of the Swan River district, wintering at Fort Alexandria, which is actually near Kenora. He kept a journal that still survives. Now, Cease McNee told me he confirmed his own lack of knowledge on the topic, but eventually put together a background paper with considerable detail.
A newspaper man in Kenora, Ralph Davis, mentioned to me over coffee that we had some of the most important forts in Saskatchewan right under our nose, and nobody's doing anything about it. So I inquired here and there and all over, and we eventually found the forts, and the newspaper man was right. The Fort Alexandria was the third oldest continuously settled fort in Saskatchewan. And it was one of the biggest forts, named after Alexander Mackenzie, the map maker. David Thompson spent time there, and Daniel Harmon ran the fort for a while. And Daniel Harmon is the most quoted person in the early fur trade history. And the fort was like a city block. It was a factory fort, which meant they made things to supply other forts, including salt and sugar and pemmican and big fields and stuff like that.
So just let's locate where that fort was.
This is the early fur trade, so you had competing forts in that area. In fact, there's about five, but the big one was the Northwest Company Fort. It's on the Assiniboine River as you go north of Kenora. If you went 1 mile east, where the highway crosses the river, 1 mile east on the south side of the highway. There was also a Hudson Bay Fort on the opposite side, and this is the way they did things. There were competing companies. One company would set up a fort, the other company would set up one right beside. And that one is north of the Assiniboine, also to the highway crosses the Assiniboine.
So the Northwest Company Fort was on the south side. It was Fort Alexandria.
Correct.
Was the Hudson Bay Company Fort on the north side of the river? What was
it called? That was called Fort Hibernia. And if you do the research, you'll find a lot of these small forts, they abandoned them and then took that name and named another fort with the same name, and, you know, they kept going like that. But that was recognized as Fort Hibernia.
And so what was the time frame that these forts were first set up?
We're looking at the earliest dates we can find maps and any data is 1795. We're talking forts that are 220 years ago. There were Europeans roaming around here, mainly fur traders, and well, in fact, more than roaming around here, they built actual forts here.
These forts then basically became supply forts to other company forts up and down the river. Is that an appropriate way to describe it?
No, just Fort Alexandria was. That's the big one. The other smaller forts, there's the XY Fort a little bit upstream, which we haven't located exactly yet. Other forts were just like trading posts and traded furs and stuff like that. But Fort Alexandria, they actually held the goods and supplied, made stuff. You know, they had a meat house in Fort Alexandria that held, I believe it was 60 cows, buffalo cows, yeah. You know, there's no abattoir in this area that's that big, but it shows you the extent to which they were making stuff. They made sugar here. We know that from the diaries of Daniel Harmon. They made salt here on the Key Indian Reserve. There's a salt lake, and it looks like that's where they evaporated the water to get the salt. And, you know, they made canoes or boats, buffalo boats, hide boats, because the birch bark, there wasn't birch bark, big trees around here. And, so they built lots of stuff. Oh, and they had gunsmiths, blacksmiths here. So they repaired guns, made nails and knives and buckles. And it was a whole community here.
So given that they had access, just getting back to the meat house point, that they had access to bison in that number, obviously prairie buffalo or bison were grazing that far north in the late 1700s.
Yeah, and in fact, this was almost like the northern limit of the buffalo. And that's one reason why the fort was located here. Now, we could go into the plains, you know, around towards Regina, and yeah, there was buffalo roaming there, but there's no furs there. And you have a confluence of several things here in Fort Alexandria. You have the buffalo coming. You also have lots of furs here, lots of sloughs and rivers and you know, so lots of your business stuff here. You also had it was the sort of the upper reach, navigable upper reach of the Assiniboine, so that you could navigate down to Winnipeg. Well, it wasn't called Winnipeg then, but down the Great Lakes. But you could also portage across between Norquay and current Norquay and Pelly, and go down the Swan and go up to the Hudson Bay. And those are several reasons why this was a key location.
That again, Cease McNee, now retired as a school teacher. He taught shops in Kenora. I hope he gets back to this historical research. Again, this is kind of part of our tribute to Canada 150 series. Now, one of the chief references for Cease's fort studies was Daniel Harmon's diary, considered to be one of the best sources of fur trade information prior to 1821. That's the date when the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company combined as one. The Harmon Diary is available at the University of Saskatchewan bookstore, for example. I'm sure there are other sources and likely through libraries as well. You might also be interested in a DVD produced by Access Communications available at the Kenora Railway Museum. It includes pictures of artifacts which were recovered by the McNee investigations. Now, also want to note that just west of Priestville, a large boulder stands guard alongside the original Hudson Bay Company flag right by the highway there. It's thought to be part of the route once surveyed by 18th century explorer Henry Kelsey. So lots of history in this area tied back to the fur trade. And another historical note that I want to mention, mentioning the old brick mill, there's a fundraiser coming up in September. A former Yorkton girl, I'll call her, Judge Nancy Morrison, is going to be here talking about some of her family connections to the Hopkins and Christofferson families, who were settlers of the York Colony back in 1882. You can get tickets for that at Parks Jewelry, or track down somebody like Vern Brown, who are on that that brick mill committee, or send me a note and I'll get you connected. Well, it's on the land from the rock, and again, our connection to Canada 150. As we all know, there are many ways to study and enjoy history. Tomorrow, a tour heads out from Churchbridge to examine historic cemeteries in that area. Part of the Churchbridge Canada 150 celebrations, Brian Watson is one of the tour leaders.
So the Heritage Cemeteries Project has been around since 2004. And we are a non-profit charitable organization, and we look after some of the historic cemeteries in the RM of Churchbridge and Langenberg. And by historic, I'm basically talking about cemeteries that no longer have an active church affiliation, so nobody really responsible for maintaining the grounds or cutting the grass or things like that. So we kind of take on that responsibility for those cemeteries.
So you're the hands-on. How many cemeteries might that entail, and how many people would be involved?
There are around seven cemeteries that are within our mandate in the RM of Churchbridge, and one or two in the RM of Langenberg. Just kind of the way the RM maps go, most of the cemeteries are kind of on the north side of the Yellowhead Highway that we look after. There's probably in the neighborhood of 15 people or so that are on our board. They're kind of tasked with looking after these cemeteries. And a couple of them we hire out for cutting the grass.
Let's ask a dumb question. Why?
I don't know if that's a dumb question. I think it's a really good question. I think part of it is all of us kind of have a sense of history, both from a genealogical perspective and then just, you know, wanting to respect the people that have come before us, 100, 150 years ago now. I think it gives us a bit of a sense of roots, really, because, quite frankly, most of us are related to or have our ancestors in these cemeteries. And if we're not doing this, they're just going to be lost to history. A really good example of that is the Logberg Cemetery. It's an Icelandic Lutheran cemetery northeast of Churchbridge. And the church closed down, I think, in 1960, somewhere in there. And in the early 2000s, when our group got going, we had to recover this cemetery from the bush, literally. Trees were 18 feet high. Graves were unmarked. You go back historically, a lot of these graves were marked with wooden crosses or wooden markers, and then just through general weathering or if a grass fire goes through, these things are gone. And so this cemetery was at risk of just being lost forever, because it's not even right on the roadside. You've kind of got to go, through a field and through a little trail that's probably a half mile off the road.
So how do you fund yourselves?
Well, we live off of the donations of the people that support us. You know, we have a few endowments that have been set up for us, but that's how we fund ourselves, and so money is allocated to each of the cemeteries.
So I know everybody is busy these days. How do you schedule things? Like, do you have regular get-togethers, or how does that work?
Well, we have regular board meetings. And so we do try to get together three or four times a year to discuss how the maintenance is going, or if there are any special issues with any of the cemeteries that require special attention beyond just mowing, and a little bit of headstone cleanup. If there's been anything that happened that toppled over some of the headstones, that may require some extra attention. We do have an annual general meeting, and then as far as just doing the maintenance, most of the people on our board, quite frankly, are retired. They do most of the maintenance, or like I said, in a couple of places we do hire out, because we're always open to strong backs and a few younger people with some interest in local history, for sure. We're going to try and hit about 9 cemeteries. Not all of them are within our mandate, but some of them just have also some historic value, even though they're being maintained by another group. But we want to be able to appreciate that as well.
I'm not sure how long you've been at this, Brian, but I'm sure there are many stories that you have. What's one of your best historical finds, or something that really jumps out from your experience with this, with a historical group?
Well, a couple of things jump out. First of all, is just the you can really see how when the area was settled from people coming over from across the Atlantic there back in the late 1800s or early 1900s, just how certain ethnic groups settled in various areas. Like, you've got some areas that are definitely Icelandic or Scandinavian in nature. You've got other areas that are very British in nature. You've got other areas, of course, in Langenberg and Churchbridge area that are Ukrainian or German in nature. And I think, you've got these little cemeteries every 6 or 8 miles, because, back in the day, they were traveling by ox cart, and so they're not going to drive 20 miles to go to church. I think some of the other stories are probably, as I'm walking through the cemeteries, you really get a sense of things that have happened, like the influenza epidemic after World War I. You just see scores of infants and young women who were buried in 1919 and 1920, and it's just it's unusual unless you understand that this influenza epidemic spread through, and you really get a sense of the tragedy that would have happened.
So that again is Brian Watson of Langenberg with the Heritage Cemetery Tour that's happening tomorrow. Now, that tour will gather at 8:30 at the Lutheran Church just off Highway 16 at Churchbridge. They plan to drive out at 9. They have a bus, likely some private vehicles. Now, they're providing lunch for just $5. That'll end up in McNutt, or you can bring your own. Returning to Churchbridge by late afternoon. Now, Brian told me that they were asking for pre-registration, but they will welcome walk-ups. But I would suggest that if you're a walk-up, probably bring your own lunch. If you can't make it, well, just stay tuned here at The Rock. We'll have some great stories from that tour. So again, that tour of historic heritage cemeteries, gathering for 8:30 at the Lutheran Church at Churchbridge tomorrow morning, and the tour launch at 9. Should be a good, hot, sweaty day, so bring mosquito stuff too, I am sure. Well, thanks for joining us here on the program, and thanks, Scott, our producer here, Harry Siemens, for joining us. We're going to reconnect with the East Central Research Foundation tour just south of Yorkton. I'm Jack Dawes.